Thanks for downloading this podcast from Love Sport Radio. For more, go to lovesportradio.com for all the latest podcasts, news, and views. Or for more, follow us at Love Sport Radio on Twitter.
It's 2 minutes past seven here on Love Sport Radio. I'm James Gray, and this is the Inside Edge on Love Sport with the Cricketer magazine. I'm joined today by Tamal Mills, fast bowler, and Nick Friend from the Cricketer magazine to celebrate the fact that England have beaten South Africa by 104 runs to start their Cricket World Cup campaign in perfect style. George Alderman was watching at the Oval. At least I hope he was watching at the Oval.
Praised a mature and smart performance from his side as tournament favourites England began their campaign in style. Morgan himself made a half century along with Joe Root and Jason Roy as the host posted 311 for 8 in their 50 overs. But Ben Stokes stole the show with 89 runs, a stunning catch and 2 wickets in as many balls to wrap up the victory. Fast bowler Jofra Archer also impressed with 3 wickets as South Africa never got close. There's a long way to go, but England couldn't have wished for a better start.
South Africa will be back in South London on Sunday to face Bangladesh, while England will move on to Nottingham to take on Pakistan. But today, Ben Stokes was the star of the show with bat, ball and in the field. He spoke to Sky Sports' Nasser Hussain after the game with 2 wickets, 89 runs and a very special catch under his belt.
That was a complete performance. Runs, wickets, run out. But there's only one place to start, and that's with that catch. Have you ever done anything like that before?
I had a little bit of a panic on, to be honest. I was a little bit further in than I should have been. I took a step in and I just panicked a bit, but I guess the nickname, the Claw, so lucky it stuck.
You look like you surprised yourself there.
Yeah, I was, yeah, it's sort of like I didn't really know how to react because I knew I shouldn't have been there, and it's probably a regulation catch if I was in the right position.
Well, you didn't win it for just that catch, you won it for all-round performance. The batting, how did you assess conditions when you were out there?
We were thinking sort of early doors. The messages back from the batsmen out in the middle were, you know, it's a tricky wicket, trying to get up to 300, 310 if someone goes, maybe 330. So I just tried to pace it, and it was quite hard to get away when it was a hard length, and obviously the slower balls were digging into the wicket as well.
They bowled well then, didn't they? They changed their plans, they bowled a lot of cutters. You learnt from that as a bowling unit?
Yeah, towards the end they were really hard to get away, boundaries were hard to come by, but I think psychologically just getting over that 300 mark is a big thing for chasing, so I thought we did well to get up there, and we obviously knew what was best for our bowlers to do because we've seen how they went.
Just have a word on this atmosphere as well. That must have been great being out there towards the end.
Yeah, it was unbelievable. It was really loud. Fantastic turnout for the first World Cup game, so thanks everybody for coming out, and we hope it continues.
Ben Stokes there speaking to Nasser Hussain on Sky Sports. This is the Inside Edge on Love Sport with the Cricketer magazine. And as I say, I'm joined by Tamal Mills and Nick Friend to celebrate England's first World Cup victory. I was slightly worried at 10:34 when Johnny Bairstow got out to leg spin. Tamal, difficult start, but England came back from it, crucially.
Yeah, they did. I saw on Twitter, I think it's the first time that anybody other than a right-arm seamer has opened the bowling in a World Cup.
Really?
In the first ball. So Imran Tahir there, South Africa throwing something a little bit left field at England, and it obviously paid off for them to start. It's been embarrassing for me. I tipped Johnny Bairstow to be my leading run scorer for the whole World Cup, so I've not got off to a great start. But I think after that it was a professional performance from England. I know Compo and I spoke on the show yesterday about, I think South Africa was a really... It was a good opponent for England to start with. It wasn't one of the deemed smaller nations who you'd expect England to kind of roll over. But like otherwise, it wasn't India or Australia where, you know, you've got a genuine chance of getting, you know, turned over. So it was kind of a team that they should have beaten, they'd have expected to win against, but a team that could also threaten against them. So I think England will be really pleased with how they went today.
Nick, I wonder if we're now going to see a bit more spin early doors against England's right-handed opening combination.
Well, I think as Fat Du Plessis said after the game, it was almost more for Jason Roy. If you go back to the 2016 World T20 final, Samuel Badri opened up, got one to scuttle through him early on as well. I think that tactic is one that has been talked about as a way of sort of going at England, but more because of how good they are against sort of the fast men early on. If you look at what they did to Afghanistan a few days ago in that last warm-up game, as much as we're probably talking about different levels of seamers, a different sort of standard of side, that was brutal, and I thought South Africa were very good. Not just Tahir at the start. I thought their plans were superb the whole way through.
Well, we're going to speak to Mekhi Rantini, a man who knows more about South African fast bowling than you can shake a stick at in a few minutes. But I was impressed by the way they bowled. They obviously adapted to the wicket quite quickly. I think they worked it out, and so much of it is about that. I mean, you know, I don't need to tell you about fast bowling, but it looked like they bowled the right length and the right sort of variations as well.
Yeah, I was impressed with South Africa, just as we've spoken about. I think to restrict England to 311 at the Oval, I think it's a really good effort, the way England have been batting the last few years. I think people would have expected England. Yeah, it's almost the case that now every time England go out in the field, they expect England to score 350, be whacking it around everywhere. You know, bowlers just getting carted. But I thought South Africa did well. They stuck in. They managed to take wickets at pretty regular intervals. You know, lots of guys for England got 50 and got out. So they were well set, and South Africa found a way of getting them out. And then I thought the depth, they bowled really well. They bowled a lot of cutters, both off cutters, leg cutters, back of the hand slower balls. They made it difficult for England. Obviously, they, as you say, they assessed the pitch early, and they realised what was a successful way of taking wickets on that pitch, and they stuck to it.
I mean, that, you know, we've not really talked about South Africa as real threat. Obviously, their batting lineup is short. I don't think it's poor. I think they have talent, but it's short. Are they a team that we actually probably need to consider as semi-final contenders?
They'll look at it in the sense that I think they've always been fortunate in a way. They've come into this tournament with de Villiers having sort of called it quits on the international stage. Because of his pedigree and what he brings and what he's done in World Cups in the past, they've always come in with talk about them. But to come in without de Villiers, with sort of Dale Steyn not fit for the first game, they've almost gone a bit under the radar. And I thought they had the perfect bowling attack for that wicket. Dwayne Pretorius through the middle, sort of hits back of a length. He's not particularly quick. Runs his fingers over the ball very well, as does Felekwayo. Thought Ngidi was very good at the end, sort of struggled up front. But I thought they had the right attack. And in a sense, England, I think that was more impressive from England to in the way they won that game than if they'd gone out there and got 400. We know they do that. But to roll the team over for 200 with a score that we thought was par, just above par, I think will really please them.
I think they can get a lot better as well. So you say Dale Steyn missed today. Chris Morris was on the bench. And I might be slightly different opinion to you, where I wasn't too sure on Pistorius today. I don't really see where he's going to take over the amount of wickets for. I think as soon as Dale Steyn comes in, he's the guy that's probably going to drop out. Chris Morris, not so long ago, was one of the best all-rounders in the world. I think he dropped off a little bit slightly for whatever reason. But yeah, not so long ago, he was tearing up the IPL and all other leagues around the world. So he was on the bench today. So they've got guys that can still come into this team and make it better. They'll obviously hope that Hashim Amla hasn't got too bad of a headache from my man Jofra taking a decent rap on the head today.
I assume that Joff bowled the odd bouncer at you in nets tomorrow.
I do not get anywhere near the nets when Jofra Archer is bowling. I bowled at Jofra 2 days ago at Sussex. He was down. And he said, "Oh, do you want to get your pads on and have a bat?" And I was already out. I was already gone by the time this sentence was finished.
I mean, that's Joff on a slow pitch. You know, that was not a quick pitch today. I mean, that's pretty exciting, I have to say, to see him. I mean, you know, you don't want to see batsmen, you don't want to see anyone get hurt, but it was a proper bell ring when it comes to bouncers, and almost the perfect bouncer. I saw Michael Vaughan today saying that he thinks that a pacey bouncer will play be massive in this World Cup because the white balls aren't swinging. Is that the way you've seen it as well?
Yeah, you get two in and over as well in 50 over cricket, and if you've got a bowler that can bowl two good bouncers and over potentially, it does make a difference. And you saw the way Hashim Amla played it. Yeah, Hashim Amla is, you know, getting towards the end of his career. He's played a lot of cricket. He's probably not quite the batsman he was 3, 4, 5 years ago, but he's still a very high quality batter, and he was nowhere on that bumper from Joff. It was a proper, you know, well directed short ball. Saw the graphic on TV. He'd bowled like over 90% of his deliveries at above 140 km, which is, you know, 88-ish miles an hour. He was running in, and he was bending his back.
We'll hear a little bit more about fast bowling from Mekhi Rantini, if I can get his name out, next.
This is Love Sport.
This is the Inside Edge on Love Sport with the Cricketer Magazine, with me, James Gray, Tamal Mills and Nick Friend. And I'm delighted to say on the line now we have a real legend of South African cricket. Mekhi Rantini joins us. Mekhi, when I spoke to you a little bit earlier, you said I was only ringing you because South Africa lost and paid poorly. I assure you, that's not the case.
I told you, that's just the reason. That could be the only reason.
I assure you that's not the case. What was your assessment of South Africa's performance? A 100-run victory maybe doesn't really reflect their performance,
man,
does it?
It's heartbreaking. You know, I thought we were standing a chance, you know, just to even to get closer would have made a massive difference. You know, I think, you know, let's not be... you know, bias or try to hide behind bushes, you know. From the point of view that I think England has bowled very well. They never gave South Africa any chance of flourishing, you know, regarding of chasing the runs, because it looks like, you know, Archer, it was one of those bowlers that you can really, really, you know, put his name up there, because he's a guy that actually won the game for England, you know, from our point of view. And then I think, you know, listening to NASA saying that, you know, someone from nowhere, and then it made me realize that, you know, when nobody recognizes you, you don't need, you know, to look back by making your own name being known, you know, from our point of view, you know. And I think he has done that by far. That's the reason he's been selected to play for England, because he's really, really a performer. He's really, really a person that really can make a massive difference within England lineup, especially from the bowling department point of view.
Makaya Tamal here. Nice to speak to you again. Hope you're well. Looking forward
yes,
now.
Yes, 100%.
Looking forward now. The game.
Yeah, but with tears though.
Looking forward, obviously. Today's done now. I'm sure, obviously, as you know, it's the start of a tournament. They'll have the chat in the dressing room. You know, you'll debrief. You'll move on. Next game's against Bangladesh on Sunday. I think I'm sure you agree. It's a good chance for South Africa to bounce back. Do you envisage much change in the team? Yeah. Or do you know how close Dale Steyn is to coming back into the side?
You know, from the bowling department, I think South Africa has bowled very well. But, you know, I look at how they started, and I think, you know, starting with Emmy, you know, getting his first wicket, he could have been a massive high hope for South Africa to try and put things together. You know, I think at the same time, from the bowler's point of view, they were so excited, you know, to be on a bigger stage. So they tried so much, you know, that they want to, you know, be seen as a very good bowling unit. And then they miss, you know, quite a lot of length. There's so many, you know, half volleys that they've been bowled by them. And then and I think, you know, from the South African point of view, it's about time from the captain point of view to choose a leader, you know, a captain from the bowler's point of view, whereby when they set themselves a target that let's try and restrict, you know, a team that's batting first in a certain, you know, target, where all of them have the same mind, they have the same thought that everything has to be done, you know, with clear mind, and trying to bowl a team out. If the wicket does not really favour them as fast bowlers, as we all South Africa, they love to see the ball passing the, you know, the ears going to the wicketkeeper in that very good length. But the wicket was not really giving them. So it goes back in a way that the way that, you know, England has bowled it, using their variation, using a slower ball, you know, it was so effectively. So South Africa, they couldn't get, you know, a boundary in a space of, I would say, 7 overs, where everything was hitting, was going straight to the bowler. And then you look at those overs as well, where they're going 3 runs and over. You know, Moham Ali, you know, you couldn't put him away, because he's bowling very well. It's almost like he sees that moment that I'm not going to go to you as a batsman. You have to come to my area. So that's one of the things that I think South Africa, we miss it. Imran, yes, he picked up the first wicket, but every single deliver in every over, South Africa will have a boundary in their over. And then those boundaries, not the boundaries of the good ball, is almost like a full toss and all kind of things. You know, Stoke has actually, he played unbelievable, you know, 80 some odd runs, you know. So I think from the South African point of view, to go forward, they need to make sure that they seize the moment, not just running in and try to hit the good area and then mixing up too much of the variation. And then we tend to forget our strength. What is our strength as far as bowlers? You know, why we get selected, you know, to be part of the team, but we tend to forget that, not knowing that what are you there for, you know. So those are kind of things that I think they need to identify as a team, and being able to move forward again then and see what they can do in the next game, because they're under pressure now.
Yeah, definitely. I think,
you know, losing by 100, and then they must know sometimes it's going to be a rain in England.
There definitely will be rain in England. That's one thing for sure.
That will affect, you know, for them to go forward. So they under pressure. Even they're playing against Bangladesh in the next game. Bangladesh is not going to just lie down and let them walk over them.
No, of course, definitely not. I think
they're going to make sure that they fight until the last ball has been bowled.
They are indeed. What are your thoughts then, moving, looking way forward now? What are your expectations of this South Africa side? What was the feeling before the tournament? How did they arrive in England? What was the expectation in South Africa? And then taking today's game into consideration, how do you see the rest of the competition going?
No, South Africa had high hopes. Everyone was wearing green and gold, you know, to support South Africa. I was one of those, you know, that they really had high hopes, you know, seeing how we bought, because we knew that, you know, in any world of cricket now, 300 and above, it will be difficult to the good team, you know, to chase. You know, and then at the same time, for the team then that has a very good lineup, I'm talking from the betting lineup, 300 is a par. You know, every team now, they aiming to go past 300 and then they can be comfortable, you know, to be able to defend.
Mackay.
You know, so I think from the South Africa point of view, if they bat first against Bangladesh, they must aim, you know, beyond 300.
Mackay, Nick here, if we look at that South Africa batting lineup, it almost feels a man light. And what can you see changes in that batting area as well? Because I mean, as much as they went for 311, they bowled fairly well. It almost felt like once three wickets went down, that change was over.
Yeah.
I mean, what can they do to, I guess, in terms of personnel? Can they get David Miller in that side?
No, it's needed. If Pretorius cannot be able to run himself out, you know, you need someone who can be able to seize the game, can take the game away. You know, because at the same time, he didn't bowl very well, from our point of view. So you need someone. If South Africa now to go forward, if they're going to select six batters, you know, including JP in the team and Imran Tahir at the same time. So they need to adjust within all of that with the lineup, because if they're going to have Makram, Amla, you know, and Quinton de Kock, those are three openers in the same team. You see? So then, if you're looking at that, you have three openers in the same team, and then two of them, they couldn't even get a ball off the squad. And then now we're putting pressure on Quinton de Kock. That's the truth, eh?
Yeah, yeah. Mackay, you're
putting pressure on Quinton de Kock. And then Quinton de Kock now, he's the only person now. He can't actually take on the game because he's worried if the two of them, Makram and Ashim Amla, they can't, you know, being there and support him. That give him that freedom that he can be able to take on the team, because they are there as being the anchors, you know, of the team to get Faf du Plessis. And Faf du Plessis, if he doesn't perform, at least you have these two that you can bank on. You can bank on them, and then you have Van de Dissen. When he walks in, at least there's a platform.
Mm.
You can't have Van de Dissen walking in with not even past 100. And then we are already on the 17th over. Come on.
Mackay, you're absolutely right. Thank you so much for helping us set the world to rights this evening. A pleasure to have you. That's Mackay Ntini, former fast bowler for South Africa, an absolute legend of South African cricket. And, well, I'm surprised his words won't go far.
This is Love Sport.
This is The Inside Edge on Love Sport with The Cricketer magazine. And remember, if you want to get in touch with the show, you can text in via WhatsApp on 0208 70 20 558. Remember to include your name with your point of view so we can read out on air. Just add Love Sport as a contact and drop us a message. We're on 0208 70 20 558. You can also give us a ring and we can take your point of view that way as well. You can get in touch on socials, on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram at Love Sport Radio. It's absolutely endless. Honestly, if you want to get hold of us, you really can. The pigeons do arrive in the window. We've talked a lot about England's World Cup success today, but I wanted to move on a little bit because there's been some revelations about the 100 this week, which have caused the usual amount of hand-wringing and spats on Twitter. Tamar, I don't think you do. Do you do Twitter? I haven't seen much. No, yeah, there was a little bit of tweeting, wasn't there, about the 100 this week. Now, the main sort of crux of this week's arguments have been the names of the teams, which are unusual, let's call them that. You know, whatever you think of the Leeds Superchargers and the London, the Southern Brave and things. Now, they are just another one in a long line of various marketing ploys that have come out of the ECB. Does it matter? Is it going to make a difference when the 100 eventually starts, which is presumably one day, I don't know when, but next year, will it actually matter?
No, in my opinion. I went on a... I thought it was good interaction on Twitter. But my initial reply was just... So the names obviously came out on social media and they're probably not the best names I've ever seen having played in all the other T20 tournaments. But my gripe was more so it was a new thing came out about the 100 and then that was just another thing for people to negatively come out with on Twitter. It's like, oh God, this is happening. Oh, let me get on Twitter and kind of troll it and then other people would start trolling it. But the names literally mean nothing. In my opinion, as a player, they mean nothing. As a fan at the ground, I can't imagine. I'm not a fan at the ground, but I can't imagine you'll care what the team are called. As I put in my tweet, I said, if Chris Gayle and AB de Villiers are opening the batting, you will not care what the team are called. If Jofra Archer's bowling, as you say, AB and Chris Gayle, these type of things are very trivial. You can look at it from a marketing point of view and the actual intricacies of that kind of that world, which I'm not very well versed in at all. I'm sure there are other things you can really pick at, but just from my point of view as a player, the names don't matter at all.
I mean, and let's face it, we don't have enough time on the show to list all the different franchises you've played for, so never mind remember them all. Nick, are you a 100 fan?
I'm a fan of innovation. I'm not necessarily.
No, it's the short answer here, isn't it?
I'm a fan of innovation. I'm not necessarily a fan of innovation for innovation's sake. There is a need to. Cricket's been put behind a paywall in the last 15 years, and on Sky, and Sky have done brilliant things for the sport, but what comes with that is that you see falling participation levels, you see things that come with that, you see the fact that people don't necessarily... Josh Butler said he can walk around as local Waitrose and no one recognises him. That shouldn't happen when you won the best
sportsman. He's
best
so middle-class Waitrose.
I would say on that, though, just to jump in, I think one of the main things for the 100 is to attract new... stars and sorry new viewers,
new
families,
fans,
people
yeah.
that, you know, your football fan that doesn't like cricket. I think that starts this summer. I think if England win the World Cup and or win the Ashes, these guys, Josh Butler, won't be able to walk around his Waitrose and go shopping. Do you know what I mean?
So yeah, absolutely.
That starts now. I think that the 100 is a part of cricket's starting
rebirth.
Now. Carry on.
But you put 11, so there could be 11 games. I think it's 2 games a week, and then so the 11 games on free to air is part of the plan for the 100. And that's not the crux of why they're doing it, but it's a massive pulling factor for the ECB. The idea of getting more people turning their TVs on, whether they've got Sky or not, whether they've got whatever channel they've got the opportunity to watch these guys in action. Hopefully, with a load of really good overseas players as well. I get that part of it. They've made mistakes, but you can pick apart any marketing scheme. I mean. There have been things that have been done. I think the biggest issue is that stuff has come out...
sort of drip-fed.
Yeah, and not necessarily... For example, I mean, these teams haven't been released by the ECB. They've come out. And that's
they applied for trade... It's actually a really good little bit of journalism.
Oh,
they applied for trademark applications, and that becomes public domain
and
stuff.
I don't necessarily think it means anyone's at fault. I just think it means from the outside, it just feels like there's been a lack of organisation, a lack of really good communication. And when you're trying to sort of upset the apple cart... I mean, as the ECB said, this is meant to be something that disrupts. If you disrupt, you have to do it in a way that still brings along the people you've got already.
But this is the question for me, is do they mind? Do they mind if those 250 people who bother to go and watch Championship cricket every week, much as they're great people and I admire the spirit of it, do the ECB care if they lose 500 fans who to gain a million?
I think the whole idea of the 100 has always been it's not about what you lose, it's what you gain.
Yeah.
And if you can gain a generation that some would say has been lost. You know, my generation got into the game through the 2005 Ashes, being on Channel 4. There is a completely different argument, which is that the notion of free-to-air has changed massively in that time. People are now looking at YouTube, at streaming platforms, or whatever, different ways of consuming their sport on TV. So actually, whether you get that same pulling factor that you got when the Ashes were on free-to-air in 2005... I don't know if that'll be the same as be the same now with BBC, but they're giving it a go. And also, people can get as angry as they want about it and as worked up as they want. And I have at times, but it's going to happen. Mm. They've got the names. They've got a draft coming in October. It's going to happen. So people, frankly, might as well get behind it.
Yeah,
I mean, I assume you're going to be getting behind it because you'll be playing in it.
Oh, I hope so, but I'm not guaranteed to play in it. People say, "Oh, you're tweeting about it because you know you're going to get X amount of money." I'm not guaranteed anything. Nobody's going to give me a contract just because I'm tweeting. Supporting things about the 100. They'll give me a contract if they think I'm
fire.
Yeah, they think I'm good enough at cricket, they'll give me a contract. But I see on our running order, we don't have long to talk about this. I could talk about this, you know.
Well, what I was going to ask you, because we were chatting a bit about this off air, is in terms of franchise cricket as well, because kind of what the 100 is the ECB have gone, we sort of need to get in on the franchise cricket thing a bit more. How can we do that? And obviously it's then evolved into a format change and the rest of it.
Yeah.
What you've obviously played a lot of franchise cricket all over the world, some very well organised, some not, as we were discussing.
Yeah.
What, if you were, say, brought in as a consultant, let's just say it, what are the things that the franchise tournaments that get it right do really well?
I don't know if that's something for me to say, but I would say I trust the people that are doing it. So once this competition starts, this will be one of the leading cricket tournaments in the world.
Really?
Yeah, because of the grand nature. They're not doing it, you know, half-assed, for want of a better term. They're putting a lot of money into it. Everything's going to be run very professionally, whereas in some leagues it's less so. But due to financial concerns, they have to skimp and save in certain areas. Yeah. That's not going to be an issue for the 100. And just going back a little bit to the new audience, and so the main thing to get a new audience, in my opinion, it has to be a spectacle. So that's why you see a lot of people out there saying, oh, why can't they just invest in the T20 Blast? You can't. There's 18 teams in the Blast, and I think a good way of putting it is, if say if you're Joe Bloggs and you're a football fan and you're flicking through the channels and the cricket comes on the telly and it's a T20 game at the Oval. So the Oval and Lords do very well out of the T20 Blast. I completely understand. I play it. It's brilliant to play it. But the camera spans around. There's 20, 25,000 people there. Even if you know nothing about cricket, you know that game is equivalent to the Premier League. Does that make sense?
Significant,
exactly.
Yeah.
But say if you then pan, so I play at Hove, and so we have a small ground, 6,000, 7,000, and at the ground, as a player and as a fan, it's brilliant. We get a great atmosphere. It's a really good environment. But I would assume, actually I don't watch my own games on TV, but if you turn that game on TV and if you don't know anything about cricket, you wouldn't associate that game with Premier League standard of sport. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it absolutely does make sense.
So in my opinion, these games have to be played at the 8 biggest stadiums in the country. And then you've got to then hope that you sell it. So they're not, I hope that they're well priced.
Yeah.
You know, I came from, you know, a single parent background. I couldn't afford to pay 40 quid or whatever for a ticket to a game. You know, Norwich City in my football side, and I'd get a kid's ticket, and that was my way of going to watch sport because it was cheap. That's what I could afford.
Yeah.
So hopefully when the 100, I don't know what the ticket prices are going to be, but hopefully they're affordable. That's the main thing, because you need people in the stadium. So then the stadiums are full and it's a spectacle.
Yeah.
And then if people are going, people are going to think it's cool to go because there are lots of people there. I want to also go, or at the very least, I want to watch it on TV because there are lots of people watching. Do you know what I mean?
It's absolutely right. It's a simple formula, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. But I understand there are a lot of people that will be alienated by the 100 when it eventually starts.
Well, let's hope that not too many are alienated, but it's all about the same thing. Bums on seats.
This
is the Inside Edge on Love Sport with the Cricketer magazine. Me, James Gray, Tamal Mills and Nick Friend. And we're joined on the line now by managing editor of Sportsbeat, James Tony. We're going to talk a little bit about Pakistan West Indies, which is the second game of the Cricket World Cup. It never stops. JT, it was a successful start for England today. The game tomorrow is an equally mouthwatering prospect, isn't it?
Absolutely. Earlier on, we're speaking to Jason Holder, and the big line that we're trying to get out of him is, is this going to be a 500-run game, which he was deftly dodging that short delivery from the media. But I think it's a fascinating game. And I do think the West Indies are one of those sides that if they get on a roll, they could be the surprise package of this World Cup.
And Pakistan equally, you know, both these sides have batting lineups in red-hot form. You know, the number of tons that Pakistan put up against England's bowling attack, which we know is no slouch, this should be a game where there are a lot of runs. Which of the two batting lineups, if it turns into a slugfest, you know, a classic 12-rounder, which of those two batting lineups do you think has more firepower overall?
Well, I think if you were going to put them head-to-head, I would definitely take the West Indies. If you look at the strength and depth they've got there, from the big man at the top, Gale all the way down, Hope obviously got some runs the other day. Andre Russell got some runs. Shimron is another player who we've seen against England earlier this year, capable of going very, very big. And look, Trent Bridge, if this 500-run record is going to go anywhere, it's got a great chance of going at Trent Bridge. So I think the other thing that's interesting is that Pakistan's top order have got a very interesting, quite low strike rate compared to the other teams in the tournament. And that's something that Holder mentioned in his press conference. That's something that the West Indies are going to be targeting.
James, how significant do you think that idea of, I mean, if you look at Pakistan, they come into these global tournaments and people sort of look at them and, I guess, assume a shambles. But they won the T20 World T20 here in 2009. They won the Champions Trophy here in 2017. They come into this, they having lost their last 11 completed ODIs. But you can never really write them off, can you?
Well, ideally, Pakistan are exactly probably where they want to be, which is they're coming in having had an absolutely disastrous build-up. I think that's probably everything that history tells us is that you expect the unexpected in Pakistan. So, losing that run of matches is probably exactly where they'd like to be. I actually think it's a flip in this World Cup. I think it's the West Indies who potentially could be the unpredictable team of the tournament. But then again, if ever there was a tournament team in cricket, it's Pakistan, as we've seen over here, as we saw 2 years ago in the Champions Trophy.
We're sort of considering that fast bowling, not swing bowling, and fast short bowling might be the answer in this tournament. If there's one thing West Indies do lack, it's a spinner. Usually that's a problem at a World Cup, but it doesn't feel like it will be this summer. Do you think that will hold them back at all?
I think it's the one week. I mean, not the one weakness, but I think it's something that clearly would give. You'd got to have to be pretty a hardcore West Indies fan to think it wasn't going to cause them some concern. But again, it was a question asked today of Holder, and as you probably expect him to do, he swatted that one aside quite nicely. But as much as we can talk about 500 runs, actually, what Jason was trying to say today is focus on the ball. And I think the bowlers are still going to have a pretty big say tomorrow.
In terms of Pakistan's fielding, I thought we'd solved this problem. I thought the Pakistani fielding like idiots thing had gone away. And then in that 4-0 defeat by England, we saw some drop catches that you or I would have been quite disappointed to put on the ground. Has there been any mention of it? Have you put it to anyone? Why does this keep happening?
Well, I watched them training today and I thought I was going to see exactly that, but they looked incredibly sharp. So I'm afraid I can't back that one up. But who knows when the lights go on, whether that's going to be different tomorrow. But yeah, it's obviously something that's followed them around forever. And if you can't field, as we saw today with England, you're sharp in the field, then you're going to be... That's what you need to be competitive in this tournament.
Yeah, I'll back that up. I've played in the Pakistan Super League for the last 3 years, and I was actually pretty surprised with the fielding. I've noticed a greater emphasis being put on it. Mickey Arthur was my coach in one of the years in the PSL, and I've had many a coffee with him and a few beers as well. And he said the first thing when he came into the job, he was like, "Nah, this has got to change." They were horrific, whenever he took over, and they've to give the guys back in Pakistan a lot of credit. They've worked hard on their physicality and their fielding, and hopefully, if you're a Pakistan fan out there, you hope that England series was a little bit of an anomaly, and you can back that up. But just likewise, I think the West Indies were particularly good when we watched them play against England in that ODI T20 series in the Caribbean this winter. The West Indies weren't particularly good in the field either.
Are we quite fortunate? This is sort of for you to know on that. I mean, are we quite fortunate in this country where you guys play on carpets? And I guess if you go to Sharjah and Abu Dhabi, Dubai, Bridgetown, they're not the same sort of outfits that you can dive on, that you can throw yourself around on, that you can trust the bounce on.
Yeah.
Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that's very fair. And I think from a young age, you're used to doing that. But who are you backing for tomorrow, James? We'll put you on the spot. What's your call?
Well, I've been saying the West Indies for some time, and I'm trying to work out where it's come from. I felt a little bit better yesterday when Kevin Peterson said that he thought they'd almost certainly be semi-finalists. I'm not sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but I think the West Indies will have Pakistan's measure today. Tomorrow. Obviously, they had that really big knock against New Zealand. They just seem to have that swagger. And look, Chris Gayle, since he's announced his international retirement, he's averaging with three figures. It's remarkable. And I think that firepower, that batting firepower, will see them through. And I just think this is... I mean, we've spoken long before about Pakistan turning on for a tournament. They can't do it for every tournament. I think this is the West Indies game tomorrow.
JT, thank you very much for joining us. Always a pleasure to have you on. James Tony there, managing editor at Sports, but he will have a front row seat. But he never gets a bad seat, James Tony. He's a man who knows how to get himself in the right place at the right time. Pakistan versus West Indies tomorrow, of course, 10:30 start. That is a bit of a mouth-watering encounter for the neutral, I would suggest. And maybe two dark horses in the tournament.
Is Love Sport. This is Love Sport.
The Inside Edge on Love Sport with the Cricketer magazine every Thursday from 7 p.m. It is Thursday, isn't it? I keep forgetting the days of the week. I don't know, I just lose it. When you work every day of the week is the same. Now, we're going to talk a little bit about Afghanistan cricket because they are, I mean, they're dark horses in this tournament in that they're dark and that not actually many people know a huge amount about them. But fortunately, I'm joined in the studio by two people who do know a huge amount about them. Nick, I understand you've done quite a lot of work around the Afghanistan team and getting to know about all the cricket in that country.
Yeah, I have done. I've always found it an incredible story. If we take away, let's take away the World Cup, let's take away briefly Rashid, Nabi, these guys. There is no sports story anywhere like this. It's not about results. It's about people displaced from their country by war, by a sport that was banned by the Taliban in their own country, banned until 2000, became affiliate members of the ICC in 2001. Only got their own cricket board in 1995. 3 years later, beat Bahrain for their first ever international win. That's 2004. And here we are, 15 years later. They've got test status. They've beaten the West Indies at a major tournament. They beat Scotland to get their first World Cup win in 2015. That's 11 years after their first ever win in international cricket. And if you think that these are kids that learned to play the sport in refugee camps in Pakistan, not even in their own country. They've moved back to their country. It's a country that we know for war. And it's a country that had no heroes, has never had pop stars, has never had politicians to look up to. It's always been warlords. Mm. And they're in this position now where if we go back to these guys like Rashid and Mujib and Nabi, who've done so well in the IPL, they've taken Afghanistan onto a global stage. It's been there before, but only negatively, only sort of with this war hangover, with the terrorism hangover. It's to go from that to having guys like Rashid, who is officially the best one-day international bowler in the world, to be that, to be representing his nation that way. They've never had that before. Mm. They've never had someone who they can look up to, can be proud to say is an Afghan.
What's been the driving force behind it? Because, look, as you say, it's a country that's been almost constantly at war.
It's hope. I can't speak from the point of view that someone's been in that situation, that's been in a refugee camp, that's gone back into your country with nothing, to nothing, knowing that you live in a highly sort of unstable, chaotic city. Kabul is one of the most dangerous places in the world still. Mm. But this has given them hope. These kids can look at Rashid and not even the money he's making, but the opportunities they're getting to leave Afghanistan, to go around the world, to be projected onto worldwide television. What they've done is extraordinary. Like, it's, as I said, there is no sports story. People can talk about Leicester City in the Premier League, whatever. They were in the league. They had the players. These guys were professional footballers. They had the chance to be professional footballers. Afghanistan shouldn't have a cricket team. Mm. It doesn't make any sense. The only bit that makes sense is where they're from geographically. And, of course, that part is different. They have this cricketing culture because of Pakistan, which, of course, has this culture. But, yeah, to do what they've done with the facilities they've got or haven't got, and the opportunities that they've got or haven't got, is the most incredible story you could find anywhere in sport.
And obviously there's a heck of a lot of talent there. You've played in the Afghanistan Premier League and there's a lot of talented cricketers there, and usually quite raw guys and unusual guys as well, right?
Yeah, definitely. I played in the inaugural Afghan Premier League last winter, last October. It was an interesting experience. You know, we spoke about the logistics and how operationally some tournaments were run, and yeah, it was interesting. But the cricket was good, as I say. It's, you know, Afghani cricketers are very talented, and especially in subcontinental conditions. Just as, you know, you go play in the Bangladesh Premier League, the Bangladeshis in their own backyard are very hard to beat and very hard to outplay, as are the Afghans. And you go to Sharjah, they know how to play in those conditions. They play very freely. They express themselves, because why not? Like, as you know, as we've spoken about, it's a case of they haven't been coached how to battle the, you know, high top elbow and, you know, bowl with the perfect action. They're, you know, so they learn to play in refugee camps, and who cares about blocking it and, you know, bowling the perfect line and length or whatever when you're in that scenario. You want to play cricket because you want to have fun and you want to have a great time. And going back to the story, I know, like, it's even been spoke, like, Hillary Clinton mentioned the Afghan cricket side in, it was in front of Congress or something.
Yeah, just that using... was before they were big, before it was the dumb
thing.
Oh,
she's an early adopter, isn't she? Yeah. She's a cricket hipster.
Yeah, you heard it here first.
She used the story of Afghan cricket of in America, where cricket's not even a thing. She used that example of how from kind of such tragedy, sport can change kind of people's lives.
That's why I'd call it the best sporting story, because it's not about cricket. It's, you can put this across. You could put this to anyone in the world that knows what cricket is, that doesn't know what cricket is, that knows what sport is, that doesn't know what sport is. Like, it's that idea of, you know, we talk about the power of sport, and a lot of the time it's quite cliche, and the unified power and all that stuff. But this has brought a country together. There are parts of the country where it's still not viewed as, you know, as interesting. But everyone in that country, whether they like cricket or not, whether they're behind it or not, can see the good that it's done for Afghanistan, for Afghanistan's people, and more than anything, for its reputation, that it can be on the world stage and not be on the world stage and in a negative sense, talking about the stuff that I've mentioned before. But it is a mental story.
And you've obviously got to know people within Afghanistan cricket and met some great characters, but also some great cricketers. Who do you think in this squad? We're going to see a lot of Afghanistan. They start their campaign against Australia in Bristol on the 1st of June. That's a day-nighter. Apart, we all know about Rashid Khan because he's blown up on the international scene, and his enormous fingers. I heard Adam Zampa talking about it the other day that he went and had a bowl with him, and he said, "Yeah, it was really interesting, but I didn't learn anything." I went, "Why?" He said, "Because I don't have fingers like him. I can't grip the ball like he grips the ball." Who should we be looking out for? Who's maybe a bit more unusual and a bit different in this Afghanistan squad?
There's a guy called Hazratullah Zazai. If you've not heard of him, you'll have heard of him in a month. There's a bit of Chris Gayle. I'm sure you've probably bowled at him.
He's very talented.
He hits it.
Does that mean he's hooky for a lot of runs?
He also has no care for running or blocking the ball.
So he's got a 60 ball 162 in a T20 international against Ireland. It probably won't. Now I've said this, he probably won't come off at all. He'll probably come off once or twice in 10 games. But when it comes off, it'll be spectacular.
Yeah, he's also a little bit older than Hazratullah. Mohammed Shahzad, the wicketkeeper, who you may have seen photos of, he's slightly rotund, to put it well. But he's not a fellow that likes to run very much. I played with him in the T10 tournament this year, and we bowled first, and I think they got scored 80 or 90, and we came off thinking, I think we've done pretty well there. And Mohammed, he scored, I think, 70 off about 14 balls or something. It was ridiculous. We chased it in 4-point-something overs, and then... Have I got time to tell a little story about Shahzad as well? Then in the Afghan Premier League, he was a different team to me, but we had it on in the hotel, as you do, and he was the captain of his team, and this speaks to his character and his, like I mentioned, the freedom of which they play cricket and the attitude they have towards it. You know, he doesn't care about fitness and things like that, but the guy doing the toss was like, "Oh, Mohammed, how are you doing? You're looking very well, looking very fit." And Shahzad like laughed. He went, "Yeah, very fit, very fit." He said, "Oh, last weekend we did the yo-yo test, which is the fitness test." He said, "Yeah, I scored level 20." And the guy doing the interview looked at him and was like, "Yeah, right, whatever, mate." And then Shahzad, he kind of gripped with a big grin on his face. He went, "I scored level 10 on Saturday, level 10 on Sunday." So over the course of the weekend, he got his level 20.
But that's the thing as well. You look at it and you wonder. They've got, I think, Phil Simmons is their coach at the moment.
Yeah.
And you wonder, with a group of guys like that, okay, he's never going to change, a man like him. But you have all this raw talent. You know, Zazai is 21. Rashid Khan claims to be 22, I think, is he now?
20.
Yeah, 20, is he?
Yeah, but, there's an issue. Me and I was talking to Jamal earlier about this. This is something that sort of gets lost in the wider story, that, to put it simply, if you grow up in a country where there is a war going on and a lot of births are happening outside hospitals, you don't have birth certificates. A lot of these guys don't. They're basing their birth, they're basing when they think their birth is on the context of where they were living, what was going on in the world. So it's
sort of using circumstantial evidence.
Yeah, because that's all they've got. And I spoke to the former captain, who told me he could be 34, could be 38, could be 42.
Wow.
But he said it in a positive way. In fact, he said to me, saves me a lot of money. Don't do birthday presents or anything. And that's where that carefree attitude comes from. When you've been at that end of the world, presumably you've seen it all. So nicking off, playing, you know, pushing forward isn't something that comes into your head. You're going to go out there and swing because why not?
Yeah, it's the same. My dad just moved to Beirut, and they say nights out there are insane because when you've always lived in a war zone, sure, you know, why hold back on a night out?
Exactly. Like,
gunfire is just part and parcel of it. Let's hope that gunfire is not part and parcel. England versus Pakistan on Monday, although I'm sure there will be fireworks because it should be a decent game. England will go into it very confident indeed. Owen Morgan says he's very pleased with the start they've made to the tournament.
Delighted to be off and running in the tournament. I think when you put in a performance like that on top of it, it's more satisfying than normal. I thought we were very good today. I thought the maturity and smart cricket that we played, I thought shows probably our improvement in the last 2 years.
Yeah, and I think Morgan's right to make that point about improvement. I definitely think, and you know, the reason I said that at 10:34 I was trembling a little bit was because there was a time when if a leg spinner had taken a wicket in the first over of the World Cup, England would have gone to bits. Now, obviously, they're going to go in. The Pakistan game's kind of their perfect second game, right? Because they've already beaten them four times in the last couple of months. Is there any threat of Pakistan coming back and biting them in the backside here?
Yeah, of course. They're a successful international side. So there's, you know, when you get two teams on any given day, it's not a foregone conclusion. And Pakistan are going to have Mohammed Amir, and they've brought in Wahab Riaz. I played with Wahab in the PSL this year, and I was surprised that he wasn't selected in the squad initially. He was bowling. I understand over the last few years, I think his performances have gone up and down and his pace has gone up and down a little bit. But as of kind of February, March, when I was playing with him, he was bowling quick, genuinely quick. So I was surprised when they left him out in the first place. They obviously decided to change that. So there's going to be two bowlers there that England didn't face a couple of months ago. Oh, sorry, less than that. It was a few weeks ago in the ODI series. So, yeah, of course Pakistan can win. They're going to go into it thinking they can win, and England, it'll be up to England to stop them.
And we'll probably see spin early on. I would have thought that seems to be now what teams will all do to England, you'd think.
Yeah, I mean, Shadab wasn't part of that one day series and he's a massive player for them. I thought England played Imad Wazim really well. They hit straight. They played him almost as sort of a slow left arm seamer rather than someone that's trying to spin the ball away from them, which I think a lot of teams haven't done in the past. Australia really struggled against him out in the Middle East earlier this year because they sort of played him as a left arm spinner, whereas Roy especially just bumped him over long off.
But he's done it to a lot of people.
But Pakistan are an interesting one because even if you go back 2 years ago to the Champions Trophy, they snuck out of their group in a weather-affected group stage. England were absolute bankers to go through that final against India. And Pakistan turned up and did a total job on them. Wahab Riaz 4 years ago at the World Cup bowled one of the best spells the World Cup's ever seen at Shane Watson. Obviously, it's 4 years ago. Who knows?
And obviously Shane Watson's camped on the front foot already, so he's quite an easy bloke to bounce, right? I mean, that's the theory anyway.
Ready to review.
Yeah, as someone who camps on the front foot and gets bounced a lot, I know exactly how hard that is. What are our predictions for Monday? Do we think it'll be a comfortable win for England? That they will, you know, whether they bat or bowl first, they will cruise past them?
I think so. I think if England are coming into pretty much every game in this tournament as favourites, aren't they? Mm. You know, you look at Australia and India being the immediate rivals, and then there's a kind of a tier below that, which you'd probably say Pakistan are in. So I think the fact that England obviously dealt with Pakistan pretty easily in the recent one-day series will have maybe a little psychological effect. But, you know, Owen Morgan's such a good leader. He's not going to let his team think that. They're going to go out there. They're going to know what they have to do. Trent Bridge is notoriously a difficult ground to go and bowl at.
Why is that? Just quickly.
Well, they cut off half the kind of a corner. They did the renovations and put a new stand in, which is brilliant, but they've also lost 20 yards of boundary. So there's always a very short edge at one side, it's no longer the type of pitch that used to seam and nip around. It's a pretty flat wicket now. So as it is for most places, because, you know, batsmen get what they want and bowlers are just there to toss them up.
It's the last place Pakistan would want to play England. Like, England have taken them for 4-4-4 there before.
Also, I don't think there's a good place to bowl at Jason Roy and Johnny Bairstow, to be perfectly honest. It's all we've got time for tonight. This has been The Inside Edge on Love Sport with The Cricketer Magazine. We'll be back here, same time, same place, 7 o'clock next Thursday. We'll be right back.
Thanks for downloading this podcast from Love Sport Radio. For more, go to lovesportradio.com for all the latest podcasts, news, and views. Or for more, follow us at Love Sport Radio on Twitter.